Great. Thank you very much, Stella. So in the next 10 to 15 minutes, I hope to introduce myself very shortly, talk about a few of the things that Pioneer is working on, and then end with some things to think about how we can move forward. It's very nice to hear some of these other presentations today because it seems like they're very complementary to what we're trying to accomplish at DuPont Pioneer, which is now, by the way, Dow DuPont. It doesn't quite roll off my tongue just yet, but we're getting there. So my family's farm is in southwest Minnesota, about 5,000 kilometers north of the equator. My wife is from a village in southern Cameroon that's very near the equator. This presents a very interesting compare and contrast. The farm in Minnesota, which is still in the family, my sister and brother-in-law and my nephew are farming, has all the inputs available to it. Transgenic traits, hybrids, new seed every year, mechanization, you name it. It goes on and on. The farm in southern Cameroon, that village and many villages like it, have very limited access to inputs and very limited access to markets. It is still very much a woman and a hoe. Very challenging. I think they're very good farmers, and I think they are excellent risk managers because no one else is going to take care of them if they don't take care of themselves. The challenge I see is that it is not sustainable. For all the reasons I like that village when I visit there, it's very quiet, it's peaceful, the chef of the village always gives me a chicken, you know, my cell phone doesn't work, so it's idyllic, right? For all those reasons, young people don't want to stay there. You know, my wife says, yeah, that's good for you, but everybody in that village, as soon as they get to an age where they can escape, they escape. A woman in a hoe just is not exciting. So what can we do about it? Well, I think it's extremely important that we actually do something about it. And there's some very good news coming out of Africa, but it also presents some challenges. If you look at poverty, extreme poverty is going down rapidly globally, and the African middle class is rising rapidly. By 2030, the middle class in Africa will be much larger than the middle class in North America. What happens when people rise in economic standing? They want better food, oftentimes in the form of protein, eggs, milk, meat. What do? To create protein, we have to have more grain produced, right? So this is, besides this big population in Africa that's rising rapidly, so is the middle class. So here's a really interesting paper. This was a combination of industry and academics that put this together, and they looked at yield increase over the last 30 years or so through by relative maturity. And one of the take-home messages of this paper, of this research, is that in North America, regardless of maturity range, of agroecological range, if you will, we are actually expanding these high-yield environments in which maize is grown. So yield continues to increase each and every year in the northern climate there by 117 kilograms per hectare per year. So the question is, why can't we improve these agroecological zones, improve these high yield environments in other parts of the world, like Africa? I think part of the answer is we actually can. So this is a paper called "Can Sub-Saharan Africa Feed Itself?" from a group of Dutch, American, and African authors. It's really a fascinating paper. In this paper, they looked at yield increases by country, and they got down to some really detailed data so they could really nail this down. Ethiopia is leading the way. That's over 80 kilograms per hectare over the last, 20 years, 25 years. Zambia, Mali, of all places. And this is in reasonably low-yield environments, challenging environments, and they're still on par with what's going on in North America. What's going on in Kenya and Tanzania? They have, likewise, some reasonable zones where they could be increasing yield. In my mind, a lot of this is about policy. Our team in Ethiopia has been there 25 years. They've seen, our business team, they've seen some of the worst that policy has to offer. In the last 5 to 10 years, they've actually seen some of the best that policy has to offer. There's a project we're working on called Advanced Maize Seed Adoption Program in Ethiopia, where we are working with USAID, an NGO by the name of ACDI-VOCA, and the Ethiopian government and the Ethiopian Institute of Ag Research. The Ethiopian government has enabled seed to come into the country, and they've enabled extension both by our team, the EIAR team, and the NGO. And we've really moved a lot of really high-quality seed out to the village level. But there's no magic to this. It is village by village, farmer by farmer, extension, doing demonstration plots. But, as with the farm that I'm familiar with in southern Cameroon, these are good farmers. They get a hold of these inputs and they can make it work. The other part of this is a strong market signal. We've worked in different ways with the government to ensure that these farmers are getting a fair price for excess production, which is a strong market signal to produce more. That village in Cameroon that I keep talking about doesn't really have a strong market signal, even though in the population centers, which are not too far away, food prices are very high, but they're disconnected. If they do get a market signal, it's from a middleman with a pickup, and he's not really giving them the fairest price. It's not really worth their time to produce a lot extra. So that's a challenge. Another effort I want to talk about, and this goes back to quality seed and fake seed and the challenges of small seed companies. There's a project we're working on funded by Gates. We're working in collaboration with CIMMYT and national research programs in South Africa and Kenya. Our goal here is to produce higher quality hybrids on a more rapid basis. So look at those two tassels. This is very late in the season, so you can't see big differences, but the tassel on your left produce pollen. And you know these tassels in Africa, this tropical germplasm, they produce enough pollen to blot out the sun sometimes. I mean, they can produce pollen. That tassel on the right did not produce any pollen. Why is that important? Why is that exciting? That's the female. That's the female inbred. So you can create that cross that you want, that high-quality cross, a high-quality hybrid, without detasseling. Detasseling costs money. Detasseling lowers yield. It's seasonal labor, which is oftentimes difficult to find, especially for small seed companies. So now we have the ability here, and we've got a ways to go, but we have proof of concept. The other part of this is, for all that energy that goes into that tassel when you're producing pollen, if that plant is not putting energy into the pollen, it can go into the ear. So we've demonstrated, even in temperate germplasm, that we have a yield increase in the seed production. We haven't quite got there yet on the tropical maize, but we believe it might be even more just because those tassels are so large and they produce so much pollen. So this could be an exciting step forward to help small seed companies then produce a higher quality hybrid and have greater turnover of hybrids. So there can be better hybrids and greater faith in the system by smallholder farmers. So you might ask, well, okay, why are you helping smallholder farmers? I think Jeff mentioned it earlier. All boats float higher with a rising tide. When a smallholder farmer loses faith in the hybrid because it's a fake hybrid or it's a low-quality hybrid and he spent money on it, he's not going to come back to a hybrid for another 5 to 10 years, or maybe ever. We're just trying to improve the overall professionalism of the seed business in Africa. I also want to mention CRISPR-Cas technology. You may have heard of it. It seems to be in the paper just about every day for some reason or another. Before I get into this, I want to stress, though, that CRISPR-Cas gene editing is simply a tool. It's not a cure-all. We still need everything else we've talked about here today. Fertilizer, good genetics, strong breeding programs. But this is a tool that we believe is going to be very helpful. A good example of where it can be helpful is with something like cassava. If you know anything about cassava, you know it's pretty much a breeder's nightmare. Long life cycle, doesn't produce flowers. If it produces a flower, very few pollen grains. If it produces seed, sometimes the seed is dormant for 6 months to a year. So if you're a breeder, you're struggling, right? You're struggling to make improvements. Yet there are a number of challenges with cassava, with disease and yield and quality, post-harvest storage. Last week, we entered into an agreement, a collaborative agreement with the Danforth Plant Science Center to use our CRISPR-Cas and transformation technology to apply it to food security crops like cassava. We believe this could very well help shorten the number of breeding cycles it takes to get to an improved plant. But again, just a tool, not a magic bullet. But I think there's reason for hope here. So I want to end with just a couple of slides more on maybe what we can accomplish here. This is from a paper that I read a couple years ago. It's from Vermeulen and Campbell. And I saw Bruce Campbell. He's from Wageningen, CIOT, CG System. He presented on this at a conference I was at. His point was, so this was 10 principles for effective ag research for development. This is just one of the principles of the 10. Divide your research into thirds. Of course, in the middle, I've got research. Of course, the technical part of research is what everybody loves to focus on. Sometimes that's the easy part. The other parts are the needs of farmers and the needs of consumers. The other third is capacity. Can that farmer handle the technology that you want to deliver? And if not, before you do too much more research, you better figure out how that capacity is going to be built. It's extremely important that we work on capacity building and understanding the needs of these farmers before we get too carried away with some fancy pants research. And finally, I want to ask the question, what's our role? I think at least part of it is promoting science and evidence-based decision making. From a transgenic trait point of view, that's all we ask. If we could harmonize some of these regulatory systems, it could be extremely helpful to Africa and the rest of the world. Think beyond research. Think towards implementation. So like I mentioned just the previous slide, think in thirds. Advocate for good policy. If you look at what's going on in Ethiopia, that can be very beneficial because there's a lot of positive things happening there. And the other part of this is, this policy is not just a frustration with a big multinational like Dow DuPont. Small seed companies have the very same frustration of trying to move seed across borders. Agriculture does not recognize political borders. Agroecological zones do not recognize political borders, nor does climate change. But yet we have all these political borders throughout Africa, especially in West Africa, some tiny countries. But seed companies cannot move seed across borders very easily because of phytosanitary laws and nothing's harmonized and everybody's got a different rule. So it makes it very difficult for a seed company, especially a small seed company, even more than us, to move seed around, even if it might be high-quality seed. So competition is lowered, and smallholder farmers and consumers suffer. So think in thirds, science, evidence-based, and advocate for good policy. Thank you. Are we predicting that GMO restrictions will be lifted in Africa? Thanks very much for that question. No, we are not predicting that. We are working very hard with a number of organizations to create awareness, educate, do what we can to make sure governments understand the benefits of GM traits. And CRISPR-Cas, in a lot of forms, is not transgenic either. So that might be an opening for us as well. Yes? A nutrient-devoid, cassava. Yeah, so here's the situation with cassava. There are opportunities to improve the nutrient content of it. We cannot change behavior in a lot of cases. So with cassava, it is a very important energy source for probably 500 million people globally. The idea is that we maintain that productivity or increase that productivity and create other opportunities to diversify the diet or biofortify the diet of cassava. So I understand what you're saying. This is a crop that my wife has grown up eating. We still eat it. I've become quite a connoisseur, but you are correct.
There's this negative impact that they have by eating this energy crop without nutrients is to me.
So until we come up with a replacement, it's the best we got. Let me say it that way. Ideally, we could come up with some replacements today. We could diversify the diets today. It's not possible. But people need that energy, right? They need the energy to survive. Could we do better? Yes. But not right now. I mean, if you stop promoting cassava, people will starve. If you stop improving cassava, people will starve. It's going to happen.
Charles, last question.
No, there's a young lady in the back that's been had her hand up the whole time.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Please repeat the question.
So the question was about the figures I showed in maize yield going up in some areas and not in other areas, and is that maize we have there MLN resistant? Today it is not. Today it is not. So there's another opportunity with CRISPR-Cas. We're working very hard with CIMMYT to develop the maize lethal necrosis virus resistance in the new hybrids, and there's a lot of effort going on to create that. So hopefully within the next couple of years we will have that. Today they're not. But right now Ethiopia hasn't been really hammered by MLN. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks. You bet. Thank you.